Time for MERS Monday, the public policy podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I am publisher John Roering, joined by our editor, Kyle Malin. Kyle, you got to spend some quality time this weekend with Republicans who reanointed a former chair again. We call it the re-coronation of Ron Wiser as chair. Why is this important for them, and what benefits do they gain?
Well, this is really important for Republicans because he actually is bringing all factions together. Even those right-wing conservative, you used to call them Tea Party, grassroots Republicans, are now seeing kind of the writing on the wall that if they're going to be successful in 2018, they have their best shot with Ron Wiser as their chair. Even Scott Hagerstrom, that kind of symbolized that right-wing philosophy, has acquiesced and realized that he just can't raise the money that Ron Wiser could raise. And we talk about this often. You know, what does it mean? What does it mean to be able to raise a lot of money? Well, when you're a billionaire like Ron Wiser, what it means is you have access to the individuals who also have money. I mean, you socialize with the people who have that kind of money and are willing to throw money to the Republican Party because they know that the person they're giving money to is not only a friend and a colleague, but it's somebody that presumably knows how to spend it and knows how to spend it right.
Now, you included a number in your article from this weekend. He literally doubled what they raised, didn't he?
Well, that's the type of impact that Ron Wiser can have. Now, the numbers that were given to me was that, let's say you're a very good Republican Party chair. You can raise about $15 million. Okay, Ron Wiser, enter him into the equation, we're talking $30 to $40 million. What that means is that's a difference between being able to fund attorney general, secretary of state campaigns, and other campaigns that you wouldn't normally be able to touch. It also means that you have the resources to actually go out and find yourself a U.S. Senate candidate that presumably has been focus grouped, who there's been some kind of ground level polling, and who you can provide a little bit of seed money to start off so that they actually have a shot at beating Debbie Stabenow. It's not good enough just to find out, oh, let's see who wants to put their name on the ballot, and then, you know, just kind of put them a pat on the back and give them a couple bucks. This is actually finding somebody that, from their focus grouping and their research, actually does have a decent shot to beat Debbie Stabenow. Now, realize that beating Debbie Stabenow is going to be very difficult, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, no matter who they get, three-term incumbent, has been very popular, knocked off an incumbent herself. She knows how to win. She's already got like $3 million in the bank, right? So it's going to be hard. But if you want to, at the very least, give her fits, then this is the process that you go through, and I think the Republicans now have a shot to actually get somebody who's going to do that.
His appointment to his chair is important for another reason, too, that's probably worth noting. If you think about the 2018 elections and the 2020 elections, the winners of these elections are the people who are going to be holding the pen for the next redrawing of districts in this state. So we're talking about, you want to have that money resource available to you as you're trying to preserve the right to draw the districts across the state, and that's going to determine who has power in this state for the next decade.
Well, absolutely. And so that you're exactly right. And so with this past election, 16, 18, 20, when they start drawing them in 2021, that's what we're looking at right now. Absolutely.
Any other big news come out of this conference or the convention that you'd like to know?
Well, I think that it's funny to see the dreaming that goes on as far as who are we going to get for a U.S. Senate candidate. And, you know, Randy Richardville was around. He put his name out there. I saw Fred Upton. He was in the 6th Congressional District caucus room, but he didn't make the rounds like, let's say, Bill Schuette did or Brian Kelly or Tom Leonard. Tanya Schutemaker made it through a lot of the caucuses as well. So, I don't know. It makes you wonder. I spoke with somebody who said that maybe Upton just put his name out there as a shot at Debbie Stabenow, since Stabenow had tried to or was campaigning with Upton's opponent last go around. So he might have been a little
elbowing going on.
A little bit of that. But, you know, we'll see. I mean, he would be a formidable candidate. I mean, he's one of the better ones you're going to be able to get. He raised a lot of money, but he didn't really, you know, up his profile much, so to speak.
Is Randy Richardville the kind of candidate, though, that could take off statewide? I mean, he's a little more moderate than this party.
He is, but it's not necessarily the other thing that I found during this convention is that what the conservative lines that we're talking about here, it's not necessarily about the traditional, how conservative are you right now? What we saw with Donald Trump is that there are certain issues right now that are extremely popular. If you're on the right side of those issues, it doesn't maybe necessarily matter. Where are you on immigration? Where are you on trade? And if Randy Richardville is on the side that's very popular, who knows? Maybe he could be it. You know, at first glance, you know, you would think, oh, gee, she's too moderate or he's too mainstream. But if he's right on issues and is, you know, has a finger on the pulse of the public the way that Trump did, Trump has shown folks that it's possible. Mm-hmm. Now, that said, I would say that somebody who has been very populist all along and has a reputation of it is Rick Jones. And while Rick Jones isn't going to go out and fundraise and raise the kind of money it takes to beat Debbie Stabenow without massive help, he is somebody who already has a reputation of being very populist and being very good with the media and very comfortable in front of a microphone. And I don't know if he could beat Debbie Stabenow, but he certainly would make it very frustrating for her.
You think he fits in with sort of the surge that created the Trump movement?
I tell you, nobody gets their hands on populist issues and runs with them like Rick Jones. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's a traditional Republican thing or not. But you take a look at the things he's championed, like the charitable gaming issue, for instance. All of the nonprofit clubs out there, your Kiwanis and your American Legion and all those like school groups, I mean, he is right there with them on that. Talking about school funding and saying that you shouldn't use school aid fund to backfill a general fund. Having a constitutional amendment on that. He's right there on that. Getting rid of this so-called pension tax. He's for that. So, I mean, he doesn't always tote the Republican line. When he sees that there's an issue out there that the public cares about, Rick Jones is there. And I think that he may be that type of populist candidate. If these focus groups well, he could be the type of candidate that could give Debbie Stabenow fits. And she's a constit, too, which I think is kind of funny.
We'll have to see if he enters that race. I'm sure he likes being talked about, though.
Oh, I'm sure he does. I talked to Tom Barrett's name was also mentioned. Debbie Stabenow is also one of his constituents, state rep. But I talked to him today. I don't think that's really something that he's ready for right now. But I think state senate may be more in his plans. But you know, certainly the Republican Party's looking. I'm sure it's not going to be somebody like Kid Rock or whatever was out there. You know, that's kind of a pie in the sky kind of thing. But again, Ron Weiser gives them the ability to go out and try and find somebody who kind of fits a mold that they can go and get Stabenow with.
All right. It'll be great to see what he does with it.
All right. Well, thanks, John. I'm going to turn things over now with Abigail Walsh. She's joining us here. She was at the Democratic Convention. Now, Abby, 5,000 people, you say, crammed in Cobo Hall for the Democratic Convention. Now, how were they received and were they well-behaved? I guess that's the critical question.
There were just a little under 5,000 people crammed into Cobo Hall just for the Democratic Convention. The space was, of course, shared with a couple other events. But when you arrived at around 10 o'clock for the registration time, I mean, lines were almost all the way out the door. And it was pretty orderly. It was crowded, but it was a pretty orderly affair, except when you got into the caucus rooms. Those were mostly, you know, stuffed to the gills. There's a little bit of drama in a couple of the caucuses. The Progressive Caucus and the LGBT and A caucus were the most talked about in terms of this influx of new energy, new activist energy, generally more progressive than where the base has been in prior years. And they were, you know, really active in changing up who's in charge of the party and looking for new leadership for 2018.
Tell us how visible Gretchen Whitmer and Dan Kildee were at the convention. Obviously, Gretchen Whitmer's already declared that she's running for governor. It's expected Dan Kildee will at a certain point. How visible were they?
Easily some of the most visible candidates all day were gubernatorial candidate Gretchen Whitmer and potential gubernatorial candidate Dan Kildee. They had volunteers walking the halls. They had signs in every room. Kildee and Whitmer were both very visible in each of the caucuses, in each of the congressional caucuses. Kildee gave a speech, however, on the convention floor, which Whitmer did not, and granted all convention members, convention speakers were elected members who participated at that time, and currently Whitmer does not hold elected office. Whitmer, by her own admission, said she was most well received in the Progressive Caucus, which I think sort of cements her cast as the Progressive Democrats' choice candidate.
Was anyone else acting like a statewide candidate that you could see?
As far as anyone else acting like a statewide candidate, you did see, for example, Jocelyn Benson coming around, presumably to run for Secretary of State again. You also saw a lot of Representative Tim Grimmel, former House Minority Leader. He was there with some of the House Dems, but he did keep his distance, shaking hands, was seen, acting a little bit more like he may really be seriously considering a run for Attorney General, as has been rumored.
And what about Detroit Mayor? Did Senator Coleman Young make an appearance? We've heard his name for Mayor Mike Duggan. Who is out there in that race?
Interestingly, despite the convention taking place in Detroit, you didn't really see a whole ton of current Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan or potential challenger Senator Coleman Young II. They really weren't active participants, as far as I saw, in the caucus, which was a bit of a surprise given the caucus's location.
And I hear you ran into a couple Republicans at the event. What happened there?
I did see a couple of Republicans at the Democratic convention. As I mentioned earlier, Kyle, the Democratic convention, the Cobo Hall that hosted the Democratic convention was shared with two other events, and one of them happened to be a boat show. And as I was leaving the convention, I saw Representative Diana Farrington and her husband, former Rep. Jeff Farrington, crossing the street, leaving Cobo Hall, and they let me know that they were in Detroit for the boat show. But it did look pretty funny given the situation.
All right, Abigail Walls, House reporter at the Democratic Convention in Detroit. Thanks for the update. This week for the podcast is Representative Fred Durhall, the new minority vice chair on the House Appropriations Committee. Thanks for joining us on the podcast, Fred.
Oh, thank you for having me, Kyle, and I really appreciate it. A constant listener to the podcast and just happy to be on today.
Well, hey, I appreciate you being on. Well, the big news this week was Representative Brian Banks opting to resign as part of a plea deal to settle a criminal matter. From your standpoint here, what was your impression or what was your thoughts when you saw that Representative Banks opted to resign?
Well, first let me say, of course we're very close to Representative Banks, particularly representing the same city of Detroit. We try as much as we can to stand with him in regards to the matters that he had going on. I think he was a great representative. I know a lot of his constituents, and they always speak very highly of him in regards to how he served them. You know, whether it be in the community, whether it was coffee hours, whether it was supporting families for Christmas or during the holidays, he was just a very good representative. We will miss his work ethic up here. I think he did the best he can as Detroit Caucus Chair. He stood really strong on no-fault issues and gave some personal advice to me as well in my first term of things that I should look out for. I think it was just a situation of something that happened or transpired in the past coming into future light. And so it's just really disappointing to see that happen. And he'll be missed. Some of his energy will be missed, and definitely a lot of his fight.
Now he would say that there were politics involved in that criminal prosecution. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I don't necessarily get into all of the political matters as it relates to, you know, the lawsuit. I did find it slightly disturbing that the lawsuit or the case was filed literally one day before the end of the statute of limitations. I think that is something that, you know, would bring up a concern of mm-hmm. a political nature, particularly during the time that it was happening, which was during the election. And so, you know, I don't get too deep into, you know, what the politics. I try to stay focused on my own district and my own politics during that time. You know, it does beg a question if it was politically motivated in that regard.
He looks like he may be running again. He could run for his old seat again. What would you think of that?
I really don't know what Brian's plans are, from some of his Facebook posts and messages. It just says that he's going to move forward. I think, as it says in which I think is important. He wants to make sure that he is still able to fight for some of the issues that he's been fighting for when he was a representative. And, you know, I don't know what he's going to do. I don't know what the future holds for him. But what I will say is that if the voters choose him again, the voters choose him again. And I think that a lot of times we have to leave those matters up to the voters. The voters choose who they think is best for them. Even in presidential races sometimes, unfortunately, however. I think that is up for the voters to decide. And if he chooses to run again, I think he may be successful.
Well, let's move on then to the budget. Obviously, okay. You have a real interest in this go around. Let's start with the things that you did like in this budget. What was it that you saw that you were like, yeah, I'm glad he did that?
Well, I'm going to tell you, one of the first things, being a minority vice chair of appropriations, you know, the way the budget is rolled up nowadays in general budget, and they're all omnibus budgets, but you have the general budget and the school budget. We always try to find closer, or we tend to find closer common ground on the general budget. And then we're kind of separated on the school aid budget, right? And so when I saw a lot of funding and increase in the per pupil allocation, when I saw funding for at-risk youth, when I saw funding for high school children or students within this budget, it was very encouraging. I didn't expect it in the governor's presentation, and so we were slightly shocked. I had to take a couple things that I wanted to get at him about and scratch them off my list, to be frank with you. But I think that was encouraging, the at-risk youth. You know, I represent an urban area, and there are a lot of urban areas around our state that are facing some real disparities. And I think that will help close the gap. I was very encouraged just by them keeping the Heat and Eat program, mm-hmm. which we fought for as Democrats last term at the end of the session, which could be matched by federal funds that would provide meals to a lot of our poverty-stricken communities around our state. I think that was very important. Mm-hmm. And so there are some pretty good things wrapped up in that budget. We're still reviewing it currently. Mm-hmm. You know, we just got the exec rec yesterday, and if you ever seen one of those binders, it's
pretty intense.
It is.
It's some pretty thick reading there. Yeah. So the things that you wished were in the budget that were not in it.
Well, I'd like to see an increase in revenue sharing, of course. I mean, you know, we look back since revenue sharing was agreed upon. I think we're looking at about $7.5 billion that states and municipalities have lost since then in regards to an agreement that was made with the state. I'd always like to see an increase in revenue sharing, and not just particularly the city of Detroit, but all our CBTs, all our cities, villages, and townships deserve to have an increase in revenue sharing. And the reason why is these are funds that are appropriated by this legislature that help local communities be able to have more police, more fire, more public services, and just more safety. And so I'd like to see an increase in revenue sharing. I think that's something we're going to have to iron out on the legislative side.
But on to the governor's point, though, he said that there's this PPT money that is higher than was expected, $135 million. Couldn't we just use that money instead? What's wrong with just using that instead of using general fund?
To that point, you know, we look at that the revenues from the PPT, right? And, you know, a concern I have is this will become basically like the Michigan Strategic Fund used to be. This will be the money pot. People will start trying to pull for that for special projects. Mm-hmm. People will start trying to pull for that for things. And I'm concerned that there may not be enough that are going that will go into an increase in revenue sharing. Mm-hmm. And then, again, those are sources of funds that we can draw from. But I think it would have made a very strong statement from the governor if he came out and said, hey, listen, we're going to fund our cities and our municipalities in my recommendation. And this is the recommendation as the executive that I'm going to lay, because I want to see an increase in city services throughout our state.
Okay. And then what else did you want to see in this budget?
Well, you know, another thing we didn't see, that community colleges were not funded. But some of that funding is probably going to be directed towards adult education. And then we'll get a chance to put more in CTE and skilled trades programs, which I was encouraged to see in the budget as well. I think that's something we've got to focus on if we have a really serious conversation about putting Michigan families back to work. We've got to invest in CTE and skilled trades. Listen, everyone's not going to go to college. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we have to realize, but not just the college aspect. In regards to career technical education or skilled trades, we are, and I can say this because they call me a millennial, one of our highest populations are retiring. The baby boomers are retiring. So a lot of the guys that came in and got a lot of these skilled trades jobs are getting older, and we're going to have to be competitive and have people who can fill that gap. And they're going to have to have the training to be able to do it. For instance, I'll give you an example. City of Detroit. There is an agreement in regards to the new stadium being down there that they will employ 50% of Detroiters, right? But we've got to have our folks trained to be able to get those jobs. And if we don't do that, we're doing a disservice in the agreement. We're doing a disservice to the citizens of the city of Detroit. So it's our job as a state to be able to provide access to that type of training, not just for the city of Detroit, but cities across the state. And that makes us a more competitive state. It will help decrease unemployment in our state, and it'll help us get folks back to work.
How do you think the governor has been doing as far as the Detroit schools? And I'm referring to Natasha Baker and these 38 schools that potentially could be on the chopping block. How do you think he's handled this?
Well, you know, I would like to think that, you know, and I would hope that he's trying to handle it the best way he can. But I will say this. First of all, dealing with Detroit Public Schools, being a graduate of Detroit Public Schools, it is very sad when you look how the district is now. And the district faced challenges when I was in the school. I went to the school when we had an emergency manager. And so you saw kind of, you know, basically the disparity between that. And then I had friends who were in suburban high schools at the time. They had more resources than we had in DPS. And then we get here, and I get elected, and I'm a member of the legislature, and in my first term, we're fighting for funding for DPS. Let's save DPS, right? That package of bills didn't reflect what we wanted to see. And now what we're seeing, because of bad emergency management, close to 20 years, we're seeing the decline in Detroit Public Schools. Even though you slap a new name on it, doesn't make it a new district, doesn't solve all the problems. The money certainly was not enough to make the district whole again. But with this SSRO and the potential 38 schools closing, I cannot explain to you how detrimental that will be to our communities in the city of Detroit.
How so? They're just a school.
Well, people like to think that there's just a school and that children just go to that school, but I'll give you an example. I've got three schools that are on that list that are probably slated to close, okay? There are no schools within 20 to 30 minutes of these schools.
20 to 30 minutes?
20 to 30 minutes. And so I say...
You're talking like a walk or a drive or what?
I'm talking about a drive. And so you close these high schools. Something like, let's say Northwestern High School. Yeah, there's Central High School closed, which is a school that was operated by the EAA, but we're not going to go there. You close Northwestern High School, which is a longstanding high school who has a rich history of Congressman John Conyers graduating from that. Judge Damon Keefe graduating from that. Even my dad graduated from Northwestern High School, which is in my district. You close that school, you devastate a community that's already facing challenges. You force kids to go all the way across town to be able to go to high school. Most of the high schools in the city of Detroit are in Midtown. And so folks have to travel 15 to 20 minutes just to go. It's always sad, and I talk to my staff about this when we're on our way home from Lansing. Sometimes we're coming home from Lansing 7:30. I still see children catching the bus away from, you know, home from school. And that's not because we're providing after school programs in these schools. It's because they have to travel from these schools all across the city and go home. We've lost enrollment because of some of these issues and being able to put schools in the correct geographical location. We've lost students to River Rouge and other cities. And so, you know, I think the SSRO, if they are the state school reform office, the term is supposed to be reform. Let's figure out how we change things, how we reform things. Let's not have our first option to be to close these schools, particularly if the state managed these schools for so many years. Let's at least try to step in and fix the problem before closing these schools.
Representative Fred Durhall, thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, brother.
That's going to do it for the MERS Monday podcast. Special thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all of our podcasts. John, I did something I've never done this morning. I actually stood on the center aisle in the Senate and the House chambers.
And you weren't gaveled down, huh?
I wasn't gaveled down, as a matter of fact. I was with a school group, and I found that that actually gave me a ticket, since we were being led by the state senator and state rep in those districts. I got to stand on the center aisle. They don't let reporters in the center aisle.
No, they never do. They gavel us down.
It was really kind of a cool experience. And you know what else I did? Don't tell Senator Hildenbrand I did this, but you know, the tour always takes you into the Senate approach room, right? And one of the kids asked the tour guide if there was a gavel anywhere. And the tour guide didn't know, and I said, well, there is a gavel. And so I went up to the head and took the gavel, and I gave it a bang to the cheers of the entire class.
Oh, good for you. It's just like being a real elected official.
Yeah, almost, but...
without the worry.
Without the worry, and I didn't have to make any decisions. I just hit the gavel one time.
It works.
Yeah, well, yeah, we got to get a gavel in here. We could end and close the podcast with it.
I've got one at home. I'll bring it in.
Oh, you got to bring it in. We'll just kind of gavel the podcast into session.
Yeah, I'll bring it in.
All right, that would be cool. Oh, and if you're wondering why I'm playing Peter Gabriel, it's his birthday today. And so I just had to celebrate the occasion. I'm a big Peter Gabriel fan. All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. John Rurink, thanks for sitting in here. Abigail Walls for the update. Fred Durhall. I'm Kyle Malin. Until next week, take care.